This is Thursday, the 10th of August, and we're at the Freiburg New Church Assembly, the first week of our session, theme being the Confucial Principle. This is the first hour. My name is George Dole, and my title is Good and Truth, an Exercise in Meta-Translation. And I think the connection with the theme will be not explicit, but fairly obvious by the time we're done. I'd like to start with a kind of parable. Suppose you're on a trip and your car begins to act up and you're looking for someone who can find out what's wrong with it and do something about it. You wind up with a choice between two individuals. One grew up working on cars, and though he's not very good at explaining things, everyone in town turns to him when they have car troubles. And the other has read everything ever written about cars and how they work, and everyone in town is impressed with his library. I trust it's a fairly obvious that this is a parable about the relationship between doctrine and life. The people we turn to when we're hurting are not necessarily the people who can quote chapter and verse. They're the people who are more interested in understanding us than in lecturing us. And I'd suggest that there's a people who are in fundamental agreement with us as to the meaning of the word good. Some of them might be able to share their depth of understanding by writing books. Others might learn a lot by reading books. But the primary thing is they have the hands-on experience, and they have the will to share that experience. So in a way, you might say the ideal mechanics are the ones who can take the general theories that are presented in books and apply them to specific situations. No two of these situations will be exactly alike, which means that there's no possibility of a book that will describe every problem a mechanic will ever meet. That's why good mechanics will tell you they learn something new every day. It'll be something that fits in with what it says in the books, but it will go beyond the books in terms of clarity and detail. It will be, in doctrinal terms, a singular that gives greater precision to some particular that fits into an even more inclusive general. Now, I've been told that a favorite question of Lewis Field Height, who is perhaps the most incisive mind our church has had, that one of his favorite questions was, for instance, when a student would go off on a doctrinal excursion, he would say, for instance. And the mechanic who reads an article about spark plugs knows the for instances. He knows from experience what that article is talking about. Do I know from experience exactly what our theology is talking about? What do I call good? That is, can I in fact make an effective connection between doctrine and life? In this case, between the doctrines and my life. Well, thinking along these lines has led me to try something that I'm tentatively calling meta-translation. Meta being a prefix of Greek ancestry, meaning after or beyond. It involves regarding the general terms of the theological works, like good and truth, as blanks, and filling them in with for instances. So that, for example, when I read something about verum naturale, or natural truth, I have to fill in that blank with a specific instance of natural truth from my own everyday experience. Of course, you realize this assumes that the doctrines are actually talking about ordinary things that we experience in our lives. It's a bit of a pain because it means I have to stop and think. But I hope that by the end of the talk, you'll at least suspect that it may be worth it. I'm going to be working with a sample. It's most of the little chapter, the sort of introductory chapter on good and truth, from the work variously known as The New Jerusalem and Its Heavenly Teachings, The Holy City, A Spiritual Guidebook, or The New Jerusalem and Its Heavenly Doctrines. But before taking the plunge, I want to call your attention to something both Lee and I have observed about this material. Namely, that while it says at the outset that nothing is more necessary or important than to know what good and truth are and how they are related to each other, it focuses entirely on how they are related to each other and never tells you what they are, never defines either term. There are three basic premises of the following meta-translation. The first is that in my own interpersonal relationships, what is actually good is caring about your well-being. And what is true is understanding clearly what is on your mind and on your heart. The second premise is that there are not two compartments in my soul, one containing my feelings and thoughts about you, and the other containing my feelings and thoughts about myself. I am to love the neighbor in the same way that I love myself. I'm to see myself in the same light in which I see my neighbor, namely the light of our faith. And the third is that I am, related to this last one, I am a microcosm who will be accepted into heaven only if I accept heaven into myself. And there's an even deeper underlying premise, namely that heavenly happiness and eternal life are all about how we love and understand each other and ourselves. The work itself, NJHD, represents Swedenborg's first overview of our theology. And it starts by saying almost exactly what I've been saying just now, namely that nothing is more relevant, my interest, involved in everything, than to know what is good and what is true, what we mean by the word good, what we mean by the word true. Nothing is important to know because this is what matters forever. So with malice aforethought, I'm going to read you first John Whitehead's translation from the Standard Edition, and then Lee Wolfenden's from The Holy City, a Spiritual Guidebook, and then my own meta-translation. And I hope that going through this material twice then will leave you with enough of a sense of what it is saying and how it proceeds and is structured that the meta-translation will relate to what has preceded, that will ring a bell or two. So here's Whitehead. All things in the universe which are according to divine order have relation to good and truth. There is nothing in heaven and nothing in the world which has not relation to these two. The reason is because both good and truth proceed from the divine from whom all things are. Hence it appears that there is nothing more necessary for a man to know than what good and truth are, how the one has respect to the other, and how one is conjoined to the other. But such knowledge is especially necessary for the man of the church, for as all things of heaven have relation to good and truth, so also have all things of the church, because the good and truth of heaven are also the good and truth of the church. It is on this account that a beginning is made from good and truth. It is according to divine order that good and truth should be conjoined and not separated, thus that they should be one and not two. For they proceed in conjunction from the divine and are conjoined in heaven, and therefore they should be conjoined in the church. The conjunction of good and truth is called in heaven the heavenly marriage. There is a little connection with the theme. For all there, that is all in heaven, are in this marriage. Hence it is that in the word, heaven is compared to a marriage, and the Lord is called the bridegroom and husband, but heaven and also the church are called the bride and wife. That heaven and the church are so called is because they who are therein receive divine good in truths. All the intelligence and wisdom which angels have is from that marriage, and not any of it from good separate from truth, nor from truth separate from good. It is the same with the men of the church. Because the conjunction of good and truth is an image of marriage, it is plain that good loves truth, and truth, in its turn, loves good, and that the one desires to be conjoined with the other. The man of the church who has not such love and such desire is not in the heavenly marriage. Consequently, the church is not, as yet, is not in him, for the conjunction of good and truth constitutes the church. Goods are manifold. In general, there is spiritual and natural good, and both are conjoined in genuine moral good. As goods are manifold, so also are truths, because truths are of good and are the forms of good. As it is with good and truth, so it is in the opposite with evil and falsity. Namely, as all things in the universe which are according to divine order have relation to good and truth, so all things which are contrary to divine order have relation to evil and falsity. Again, as good loves to be conjoined to truth and vice versa, so evil loves to be conjoined to falsity and vice versa. And again, as all intelligence and wisdom are born from the conjunction of good and truth, so all insanity and folly are born from the conjunction of evil and falsity. The conjunction of evil and falsity is called the infernal marriage. That's a dose, isn't it? And here's Lee. Everything in the universe that is in harmony with the divine plan relates to goodness and truth. Goodness and truth come from the divine, which is the source of everything. This means that there cannot be anything in heaven or on earth that does not relate to these two things. With this in mind, we can see that nothing is more important than knowing what is good and what is true, and how the two are attracted to each other and united. Religious people especially should understand these things, since just as everything in heaven relates to goodness and truth, so does everything in religion. What is good and true in heaven is also good and true in religion, so I will begin with goodness and truth. To be in harmony with the divine plan, goodness and truth should be united as one thing, we, not separated into two. They come from the divine together, they are together in heaven, and they should be together in religion, too. In heaven, the relationship between goodness and truth is called heavenly marriage. All the angels there have this kind of marriage inside them. That is why heaven is compared to marriage in the Bible. The Lord is called the bridegroom and husband, and heaven and religion called the bride and wife. Heaven and religion are called this because the people in them accept divine goodness according to true ideas. All the understanding and wisdom of angels comes from this marriage. None of it comes from goodness separated from truth or truth separated from goodness. It is the same for religious people. Since the relationship between goodness and truth takes the form of a marriage, we can see that goodness loves truth, and truth loves goodness. They want to be together. If we're religious but do not have this kind of love and desire, we do not have this kind of marriage inside ourselves. This means religion is not yet inside us, since the relationship between goodness and truth makes religion. There are many different kinds of goodness. In general, there is spiritual goodness, material level goodness, both together in genuine ethical goodness. There are the same kinds of truth as there are of goodness, because truth goes with goodness. It is the form that goodness takes. It is the same with evil and falsity as with goodness and truth, except that they are opposites. Everything in the universe that is in harmony with the divine plan relates to goodness and truth, and everything that is opposed to the divine plan relates to evil and falsity. Goodness and truth love to be together, and evil and falsity love to be together. And all understanding and all wisdom grow out of the relationship between goodness and truth, but all irrationality and foolishness grow out of the relationship between evil and falsity. The relationship between evil and falsity is called hellish marriage. And here finally is my meta translation. I just remind you that for goodness in general, I'm substituting caring about you And for truth in general, I'm substituting truly understanding you, roughly. My entire humanity, to the extent that I am truly human, comes down to caring about you and seeing you clearly. This applies to everything in my soul and in my body because both the caring and the seeing come from the deity who is the source of everything. Clearly then, this means that nothing is more relevant than knowing what true caring and clear sight are and how they interact with each other, how in fact they are united to each other. This is especially relevant to my relationships because just as true caring and clear perception are at the heart of everything within me, they are at the heart of my relationships as well. This is why I need to get this straightened out first if I want to understand what life is all about. When I'm functioning the way the Lord created me to, my caring and my perception are not two separate activities, but they are one single motion of my whole being. Because they come from the Lord as a single energy and are a single energy in the depths of my being, so they should be a single energy in my relationships to others. If I knew this oneness in depth, I would find myself referring to its intimacy as a marriage. All my ability to comprehend and evaluate comes from this oneness. Caring without perception accomplishes nothing. Perception without caring accomplishes nothing. And this is true of my subconscious and my conscious mind alike. Because the oneness of my caring about you and my perception of you is a kind of marriage, I can see that when I care about you, I truly want to understand you, and that the more clearly I understand you, the more deeply I care. Each motion of my being feels unreal if it is separated from the other. If I find myself not longing for this kind of wholeness in my relationships with you, I have not found inner wholeness. This means that I have not yet let the full meaning of heavenly community into my heart or my mind, because it is this oneness that makes a community heavenly. There are different levels of caring. Roughly, there is inner caring and there is outer caring, and these come together when I act responsibly toward you. Just as I have different levels of caring, I have different levels of perception. This is because caring is what gives rise to my perception, and the way I perceive you gives my caring its focus. There is a mirror image of the relationship between genuine caring and clear perception on the one hand, and malice and distortion on the other. That is, just as my true humanity is a matter of my genuine caring and clear perception, my inhumanity is a product of malice and distortion. Or again, just as I want to understand you when I care and find my caring stirred when I understand, so when I'm feeling resentful, I look for the worst in you, and the more I focus on that worst, the more I resent you. And again, just as my ability to comprehend and evaluate comes from the union of caring and perception, the union of malice and distortion makes my life utterly senseless and futile. And this kind of marriage is pure hell. Well, that kind of exercise brings me about three-quarters of the way to applying the doctrine to life. And the last step would be filling in the blanks with specific names and specific instances with a particular you who wanted to share some concerns with me at 3:37 yesterday, with the specific feelings and thoughts that occurred to me and with the specific way I processed and responded to those feelings and thoughts. Or perhaps the specific you was the Jehovah's Witnesses who rang my doorbell at 9:23 a.m. on March 14th, or the telemarketer who called in the middle of dinner yesterday. And as you might suspect, I'm not quite through. It struck me quite forcibly when I reviewed the meta-translation that the lack of definition of goodness and truth, the fact that that never tells you, defines either term or tells you what they are, really was no longer an issue. In part, of course, this was because I had assumed a kind of definition by choosing caring and seeing you clearly as more specific instances. But there's more to it than that, because there is no necessary unanimity as to what genuine caring is or what clear sight is. When we look at the relationship between them, though, something very interesting happens. It turns out that each is a kind of test of the authenticity of the other. That is, if I think that I care about you, but don't really want to understand what is on your mind and heart, that isn't genuine caring. And if I think I see clearly what is on your mind and heart, but am not moved to care about you, that is not clear sight. And the more I think about it, the more rigorous a test this seems to be. Try it. You might not like it. That's the clue. The floor is yours. Lois. That.
Lois McCurdy. I was thinking in the beginning, if you lacked a definition and it was important, that there were many, many pages, if you go through Pott's Concordance, you can find some varied definitions of love and of truth, and that mm-hmm. you can then apply it to this particular passage. But then at the end, you sort of said that it didn't become a problem because they were a test of each other. I just was thinking about you hesitating, making you hesitate to think about something natural and how it applies to your life. And I was thinking one time in my, I'm still impetuous, but my impetuous youth, George.
you had a non-impetuous youth?
Yes, right. I can remember there was someone who came in very raggedy clothes to our church in Boston and asked for a handout. And being the affection of our union, yes, let's help him out, let's give him money or whatever. And George said no, and I was appalled. I thought, this man that I live with, that I love, is being so mean. But he was doing the right order. Truth is first in time, and he was thinking this was not a wise thing to give this man money, because obviously he looked like he had a problem with drinking. So he did the most charitable thing. He offered him, he said, I have an arrangement with the restaurant. And the man was asking for money for food. Mm-hmm. He said, I have an arrangement with the restaurant, and you can go down and you can get a meal on me and order anything you want, mm-hmm. and the church will pay for it. And I thought, that mm-hmm. yeah. is a wise way of loving. So he was yeah. really loving the man in the end, but he was applying some wisdom. I don't mean to make you the baby, but it was just an example.
Everybody has a good day once in a while.
Right. So I just thought it was a wonderful way yeah. of showing wise love, using truth that he knew of or that he suspected, yeah. and then really loving in the end.
Yeah. One of the things that's been nagging at me lately is that we believe that the Lord is perfectly merciful, infinitely merciful, and infinitely just. And that means that, contrary to our own frequent experience, there really is no competition between justice and mercy. We often feel one pulling us one way and the other pulling us the other way. And this then gave me a different slant on a couple of things. One is the familiar thing in Deuteronomy and Joshua, do not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And sometimes this is read in the church as, don't let anybody get in your way. You be righteous, and if it tromps on somebody, let it tromp. Roll over on the steamroller approach. And I said, no, that's not what it means. This is like the straight and narrow way. Don't turn aside from the right to the left, because you're on a tightrope. Yeah, a very, very different feel to it. And to try to discover, and we don't always find it. Often we don't. But to try to realize that when we do not find the thing to do or say that doesn't perfectly blend justice and mercy, that's our problem. And we haven't really found that very narrow, very tight way where they coincide.
D. Mm-hmm.
This is Lee Wolfenden. While you were preparing to read my translation, I was fretting a bit. I was thinking, now let's see, did I use the substantive or not in this particular place?
Yeah.
Because I don't remember everything in that translation. Probably would change a few things at this point. Mm-hmm. But the point being, did I say nothing is more important than knowing what is goodness and what is truth, or what knowing what is good and what is true?
Yeah.
And then as you were reading, and later as you were reading your own, I also came to the same conclusion as you did. It doesn't really matter that much. One is just a variation of the other. Knowing what is goodness and truth in the abstract, knowing what is good and true in practice, it's really the same thing. Mm-hmm. You can't know one without the other. You can't know abstract goodness and truth without knowing what in practice is good and true. Mm-hmm. And that is a personal knowing. That was my comment.
Yeah. And it is, I think anybody who gets involved in translating sympathizes with the, John Chadwick quoted the Italian, which I probably get wrong, traduttore, traditore. The translator is a traitor. there are so many levels of language, from the phonetic up to the very abstract and stylistic, and you're always sacrificing something. If you're going to translate a term, a word, for example, that really faithful to context, you cannot use the same word to translate the same word every time. There's no way you can do that. So you have to choose, do I sacrifice consistency or do I sacrifice context, responsiveness to context? And so any translation can be critiqued from that point of view. And the best, you have to establish your priorities, and the best, I think the most responsible way to establish your priorities as a translator is to try to figure out what were the priorities of the original author. I may have said this before. So when I was in college or grad school, I did a translation just for kicks of a marvelous little German book, children's book of poems of Max und Moritz, who this was a cautionary tale for sort of Victorian things about these two kids who were always getting into trouble. And it's by a man named Wilhelm Busch, who had a wonderful time with the German language, all sorts of plays on words and things like that. And a literal translation would be appalling. You need to put this into funny English, and you have to sacrifice literalism to do that. But on the other hand, and sometimes there are plays with sound and things like that, and you want to reflect that with some little plays in sound in English. Well, now suppose somebody gives you their grocery list in German and says, could you translate this into English? And they say, now, I've got to catch the rhythm and the sound of this thing. I don't, no, that's not what the priority is at all. And what were Swedenborg's priorities? And if you, we actually have some clues, because we do have manuscripts that show the changes that he made, show what he crossed out and what he substituted, and what he did, what he wrote and didn't like, and how he altered it, in what direction. And the general direction is usually clarity, simplicity. You do not write profound ideas in simple language without trying. Anybody can write profound ideas in incomprehensible language. any number of examples of that. But no, you have to really work at it to boil this down to a very small vocabulary. And one of the, Lisa Hyatt Cooper put it simply, you know, this often Swedenborg's language is on the level of see, spot, run. Extraordinarily simple, straightforward language. That's why I can handle it usually. Jesse. Mm-hmm.
Jesse White, I just wanted to say that your meta translation was so much easier to understand and meant so much more to me personally. And I just wonder if there's any way to do more of that, to to make it more accessible to more people, and or maybe even just provide the sort of instruction on how to do that yourself. But in other words, saying, well, we could translate good as caring about someone, and then kind of we could read it ourselves that way. But it made the writing so much more understandable and meaningful for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hoping that something like this can have an appeal and a use. And this is a first stab. Yeah, I saw George over there.
Mm-hmm. George McCurdy. As you gave your opening statement about the gentleman in town who could fix cars, and the other fellow had books, I don't think you're either one of them. I picture you as the guy that knows how to fix things, but you go to your books on the shelf to see how the part is put together and what part to order. And I think a lot of us are that way. I don't like either extreme. I think we need truth inflowing of what makes this engine run. And so I wish, George, if you ever do this presentation, you offer us the third kind of guy. but you did offer a challenge, and Tony Regame used to have a little poem that he had up on his wall, and I hope I can do it justice because I tried to memorize it, but it goes something like this. Within this temple of mine, there's a crowd. There's one that's humble, and there's one that's proud. There's one who's repentant over the sins, and there's one that sits in the corner and grins. From much perplexity, I would be free if I knew which one was me. I'm taking to heart what you said, but I really, there's something that's attractive of hands-on and the knowledge.
Yeah.
And the knowledge is helping me to be a better hands-on guy.
Yeah, and the two have to be in dialogue with each other. There's no question. Yeah, I was given a little card, little motto to put up, and I thought it was just the serenity prayer, you know, Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the what I can't change, and the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And then finally one day I actually read it, and it said, Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the people that I can't change, and the courage to change the person that I can, and the wisdom to know that it's me.
When you were reading your I'm right here.
who said that?
Oh, Laura Grams. When you were reading your meta-translation, you know, one of the things I find when I'm working with people that said so clearly, I want to put it on my wall, is that so many times we think about behaving well, and it's almost like understanding well and thinking well have so much more to do with being happy and loving well. You know, how many times do we actually get in trouble more because of the way that we're perceiving what's going on, not actually, you know, looking at the outward actions, but trying to understand somebody instead of thinking, okay, I know what they're doing this for. And so much of what you said there was, no, if you really love someone, you're saying, why? You're trying to, you're being curious, you're asking the question, what is really going on in this person, you know, that I'm reacting to, and just almost coming to it with an understanding that you don't really understand.
Yeah.
If you're reacting negatively, are you really understanding?
Yeah. And I will go to my grave grateful to Guard Perry for his tennis lesson, the metaphor. He worked with a man named Ben Ahn, whose theory of what goes wrong in tennis is that people, in effect, people aren't focused in the present. That is, when the ball is coming across, they're thinking about hitting it. And when they're hitting it, they're thinking about where it's going to go and things like that. And he trains people to say, when the ball is coming across, how do I get to it? When I'm hitting it, where does the racket meet the ball? And so on and so forth. And it struck me that this is a perfect metaphor for a conversation, that so often when someone is saying something to me, I'm thinking, how am I going to answer? What am I going to say? And when I'm saying something, I'm saying, how are they reacting? what are they thinking? And no, what, and I've got to learn to be present when they're talking. Just please listen, for heaven's sake. And then when I'm talking, just try to say what I feel as well as I can, and then shut up and listen. You know, and it is a discipline, but I think a very ultimately a very necessary